Today on Against the Grain, Ayn Rand's novels The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged have been called gateway drugs to right-wing ideas for so many Americans. And while the works of the writer and philosopher have seen a resurgence since the global economic crisis, her influence has been undeniably huge and sustained since those books were originally published in mid-century. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'll speak with historian Lisa Dugan about what's at the heart of Rand's enduring appeal. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The list of CEOs and Hollywood celebrities who revere the writings of Ayn Rand is lengthy, from Whole Foods founder John Mackey, Apple's Steve Jobs, Wikipedia's Jimmy Wales, PayPal's Peter Thiel, to Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie, Jim Carrey, and Eva Mendes, to name just a few. Ronald Reagan was a great admirer, and former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan was part of her small inner circle. Lisa Dugan suggests that the strength of Rand's appeal is not simply based on her ideas, which promote hypercapitalism and selfishness, an argument she expounds in her book-length essay, Mean Girl, Ayn Rand and the Culture of Greed. Dugan is professor of social and cultural analysis at NYU, and she joins me today to examine the origins and influence of Rand's work. Rand, of course, has always been popular, but why do you think that she has seen such a resurgence since 2008?
I mean, I've been interested in Rand for a long time because she's cited a lot by people in business and politics, and so she's an iconic figure that's on the reference list of a lot of especially people who are involved in right-wing and libertarian politics, but actually a surprisingly much broader range of people. But in 2008, her sales spiked again. They went up rather sharply after the financial crisis because the scenario of financial crisis echoed the apocalyptic scenario in Atlas Shrugged for a lot of people. So all of a sudden, there was a massive spike in the sales of her books, but also in references to her in public. So, for instance, many Silicon Valley tycoons cite Ayn Rand as an influence or an icon or a model. People like Peter Thiel and Jeff Bezos, right? A very wide range of Silicon Valley tech gurus do. But then also on sort of the other end of a certain kind of spectrum in U.S. politics, almost the entire Trump cabinet, right? Well, people in 2008 who were not in his cabinet yet, but the people who are on the right wing of Republican politics, like Paul Ryan, right, were promoting Ayn Rand rather visibly. So there was lots of stuff on YouTube about Ayn Rand. There were many newspaper articles, people citing and quoting Ayn Rand, and a lot of really powerful politicians, bankers, because Alan Greenspan was a major Ayn Rand. He was in her close circle of advisors. He was part of the Ayn Rand collective. Alan Greenspan, the guru central banker, who was actually proved quite wrong in 2008. But a lot of people who were big fans of that whole school of economics and policy were also Ayn Rand. Cicado Institute has a lot of Ayn Rand fans in it. So I just noticed in 2008 how highly intensified the sort of invocation of her was. And I was curious because I thought most of these people probably hadn't read her nonfiction and maybe didn't know that much about her, but had likely read The Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged in high school and formed a kind of idea of her that informed their politics and their aspirations. So I was curious to really examine that in depth, and that's what Mean Girl is.
And it's interesting because you also argue, and of course, as you say, her novels are widely assigned to high schoolers across the U.S.
Yes, yes.
To this day, that Rand's influence it cannot only be found on various, you know, at sometimes warring parts of the right, but also elsewhere. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's very true. Just actually very recently in New York at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, there was a production by Ivo van Hove, the very well-known Belgian gay social democratic playwright. He wrote a treatment of The Fountainhead that was produced in at BAM with a very, you know, New York liberal literary audience. And there were interviews with him about why he had written this, and he said a friend had given him a copy of The Fountainhead, and it had really resonated with him as the sort of capturing the situation of the artist in society. And he had not registered the larger political field, the larger political context in which those ideas are played out. So there's, you know, the literary critic and writer Umberto Eco has this idea about cult readers, novelists that become cult novelists and books that become cult novels or cult books. Readers often pick and choose parts that they become attached to, and they don't always register the full context of the book. So there are actually quite a few feminists and gay rights people and people on the left end of the political spectrum who are also Ayn Rand fans, but they pick and choose some aspect of one of the novels that usually they read in high school that they identify with, and they don't really register the larger context. So that's another goal of Mean Girl, is to put those elements in their larger context so they come into clear kind of relief for people. They can see in what context, what kind of feminism this is, right? What kind of, right, non-marital sexuality this is, so that they put it back in its general, highly reactionary, pro-inequality, mean-spirited, indifferent, racist context.
Well, Lisa Dugan, you just mentioned that those people who tend to be influenced by Rand have not read her political nonfiction writings, that so right. much of her influence really it comes from her two novels, Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead. What do you think is so appealing, and clearly, since there's been this, although yes. very steady interest and influence by Rand, but a resurgence in the last decade, what do you think is so appealing in her writings?
The narratives and the frameworks and the characters and the plots that appear in those novels have very, very deep roots in Western culture. So the way that she produces heroic characters that have a certain look to them, right? So that they look like Hollywood movie stars. They're always white. They're usually blonde. They're very fit. Her characters, she matches their sort of moral, what she considers their moral qualities of accomplishment, with their physical attributes. And that has a long history, right, in the history of eugenics, the notion that virtue and social worthiness is tied to physical appearance, and that is about both race and class and gender. I mean, it's ironic because she was a Jewish. She was born Jewish. She was born Elisa Rosenbaum in St. Petersburg, and she changed her name to Ayn Rand. So she, though a lot of the characterizations that are the villainous ones in her books are really laced heavily with anti-Semitic tropes. So she has her villains be crooked and have large noses and have dark hair and have dandruff, and she often gives them the sort of tropes of anti-Semitism are the characteristics that she gives to her villains. So in the contemporary moment, those notions are so deeply unconscious and internalized that someone can be reading Atlas Shrugged or reading The Fountainhead and seeing, take the case of The Fountainhead, the artist Howard Rourke, who's fighting mediocrity in order to express his original vision. You can be reading that and identifying with having a creative vision and being up against people who don't share it. You can identify with that and aspire with that without seeing that he's this white Aryan icon who compares favorably with the stooped, dark, Semitic, right, characters who are trying to stop him. And the language of worthiness that attaches to those physical characteristics, it can become deeply disappeared into the cultural unconscious because those things are so deep in the kind of narratives of Western imperialism and Western so-called civilization. So she has these themes of individual aspiration and that are also very culturally deeply rooted, and she invokes them with this entire apparatus of racial and civilizational superiority with very highly gendered notions of beauty and accomplishment. And it's possible not to notice that because that's the water we swim in culturally. And so even von Hove can be reading The Fountainhead and identifying with this architect who goes against the mediocre architects to build his modernist vision and not really register that he blows up a public housing project in order to establish his vision. That it's these broader narratives that her stories are embedded in that are so widely and deeply shared that people don't even register them.
Sure. What is the power of the erotic in all of this? I mean, these are books, these are novels that people tend to encounter as teenagers. As literature, they're highly cartoonish, and they were panned when they came out. But yeah, there is a power to them as romances and as something very erotically charged. How do you see that dimension?
I think that's a crucial dimension. I think that's the dimension that accounts for her popularity most of all, and that really it's people attached to it in high school and then they don't necessarily revisit it, and it shapes their sort of libido, their libidinalized fantasies of who they want to be. And in this way, it makes a kind of acquisitive capitalist, kind of acquisitive entrepreneur, the person who pushes ahead to make money over and against all of the collectivists and the people who are trying to share everything, the person who pushes ahead to try to get the most, that person is not only doing, in Rand's world, a social service. She thinks greed is good, you know, like the Wall Street film, right? Greed is good. But also, she thinks it's sexy, and she portrays it as sexy. So her acquisitive heroes, who are also indifferent, it's very important in their characterizations that they're contemptuous of other people, that they're indifferent to the pain of others, and they show contempt on their faces for the inferiority of others. That becomes part of their sexiness, of what makes them sexy. So the descriptions repeat that over and over again about how surly and contemptuous and superior in the gaze and whose aspirations were forward marching over the inferior views of others. That's treated as like a romance novel hero, and actually her male heroes have a lot in common with the heroes of Harlequin and other and romance novels that are often like surly, handsome men, but who then become domesticated. And in Ayn Rand, they do not become domesticated. They maintain their surly achievement, and it's just she eroticizes it intensely, and she eroticizes it in the language that adolescents really are more likely to respond to than adults. They're very cartoonish. They're like comic book heroes, but they're highly eroticized and libidinalized, so that if you identify with it, you think, I'm a sexy hero. I follow my own vision no matter what others can say. I have a creative spirit and no one can get in my way, and I'm an individual. I'm not part of a collective, and that makes me sexy. She does it with female characters, too. Her female heroes are also powerful and acquisitive and selfish and greedy and accomplished, but they're also highly gendered. I mean, the men and women are both highly gendered, right? The way they're represented is highly, extremely gendered, and in her gender politics, she says women can do anything except in the end they have to be they have to be inferior to at least one man, because the essence of femininity is hero worship. That's her highly circulated quote about you have to maintain your femininity by hero worshiping at least one man. And other than that, you can be powerful and sexy too in this very, very gendered way, right? You have to look a certain way. You have to dress a certain way. You have to have a kind of, you know, white Northern European look. I think the attaching to the sexiness of the entrepreneurial figure is deeply important to people who identify with these books and go on then to, say, read Milton Friedman or join the Cato Institute or whatever it is they go on to do. They don't get converted to the kind of greedy politics of neoliberal capitalism by reading Milton Friedman. They get converted by Ayn Rand's sort of libidinalized stories. I mean, that's the real primary draw for a lot of people who become very dedicated to this version of acquisitive capitalism.
I'm speaking with Lisa Dugan about her book, Mean Girl, Ayn Rand and the Culture of Greed, that's published by UC Press. And we are discussing the ideas, the enormously influential ideas of the writer and philosopher Ayn Rand, writer and philosopher of the right. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So let's talk about Rand's origins. She was born 11 years before the Bolshevik Revolution in St. Petersburg to a privileged Jewish family, but in a society that was hostile to Jews. How do you make sense of her early years?
Russia, the Russian Empire before the Bolshevik Revolution, was extremely anti-Semitic, and Jewish populations were restricted to what's called the Pale of Settlement. Very few Jewish people were allowed to live in the cities, and Ayn Rand's family was allowed to live in St. Petersburg because her mother's family was attached to a tailor to the Tsar, and her father became part of that business. So she became she got permission. Her family had permission to live in St. Petersburg when there were a very small number of Jews living there. And also, her family was very economically privileged. Again, incredibly unusual for a Jewish family in Tsarist Russia. She identified then very strongly with Europe and with European civilization, because in her point of view, outside the cities of the Russian Empire, there was just a huge landscape of anti-Semitic violence and pogroms, and that was not an unjustified view. There were pogroms and intense anti-Semitism, but it caused her to see, to idealize what she saw as, it led her, I won't say it caused her, it led her to idealize what she termed her fantasy of European civilization. And it caused her to really disidentify with being Jewish. She never disavowed her Jewish ethnicity, but she was a very aggressive atheist, and she never referred to or made politics out of her Jewishness. In fact, she internalized, as I said earlier, some very intense anti-Semitic tropes, which she used in her fiction. When the Bolshevik Revolution happened, her family was dispossessed of the pharmacy her father was working at, and of the very nice apartment that they had in St. Petersburg, and they left town for a while, and then they came back, and then they had to share the apartment with other families, and they were pretty economically on hard times. And Ayn Rand blamed, of course, the Bolsheviks and the Bolshevik Revolution for the misery that she experienced, and that became really the core of her political vision. So her anti-Bolshevism and anti-socialism extended from that was the emotional, psychic, imagistic core of her beliefs. And so she carried that. Then she came to the United States, and she became a scriptwriter for Cecil B. DeMille in Hollywood, a fairly unlikely trajectory for a Russian girl who barely spoke English. She had been a total movie fan in St. Petersburg, so she came to Hollywood. She started to produce her script. She started to write scripts and draft novels, and then she became involved in the politics of critiquing the emerging New Deal. So she transferred her anti-socialism to anti-welfare state politics, and then later to anti-communist politics. And then after she died, this was then taken up within neoliberal politics. But the core of it all was in her anti-Bolshevism from the experience that she had growing up in St. Petersburg.
And also at that time, growing up in St. Petersburg, her vision, as you argue in Mean Girl, of civilizational conquest was developed. Tell us about that. Obviously, she grew up in the heart of the Tsarist Empire, but how she was influenced by ideas about sort of imperial domination, and then how that transferred onto the U.S.
Yes. Well, so she started out, her family would sometimes take vacations in Europe, and she read European children's literature. And she developed her earliest crush was on a figure of in a European children's story. It was a sort of conquering British hero. And his name was Cyrus Poulton, and he was her first kind of eroticized hero. And it was attached to a story that was profoundly Orientalist, and many of the stories that she attached to when she went to the movies and she did her children's reading were these especially profoundly Orientalist stories of especially British imperialism intervening in a setting of savagery and decadence and in harems and collective broad masses of humanity that were sort of out of control. That was the image of the Oriental being conquered by the British individual, right, imperial soldier. So she identified very strongly with British imperialism and with British figures. Beginning in children's literature, when she was about 9 years old, she started reading these stories and writing her own versions of them in notebooks of stories that she would write that were copies of these European imperial adventure stories. And then when she went to the movies in St. Petersburg, she also became big fans of films with similar plots, right, that featured British imperial, especially British, but not only British, sometimes also German, right, imperial figures, often in these Orientalist plots, right, going in to take over the realm of the Maharaj, and there would be elephants, and there would be harems, and there would be drugs and evil, and the British Empire would come in and clean it all up, and that would be the film that she was a fan of those kinds of film plots. But when she came to the United States, of course, the U.S. context was quite different. It shares characteristics, but it's different than the European and Russian imperial context. So it took her a little while to transfer her fantasy life into the U.S. context. And the first really, finished, her first novel was really based on the Russian Revolution. But the first big novel that was a big success is The Fountainhead. And The Fountainhead is supposed to be based on architecture, in the field of architecture, but it actually reflected her experience in Hollywood and her first exposure to American capitalism as the framework, as opposed to British imperialism as being the primary kind of narrative that she was embedded in. With the Fountainhead, she had sort of absorbed American capitalism as the context that would become the basis for her narratives. But it shared a lot. It brought with it a lot of those images from European imperialism, as in fact American capitalism did.
This was published in 1943. Tell us about, even though probably many listeners were required to read this book at some point, what was the larger argument that she makes through the characters of the Fountainhead?
So the Fountainhead, the hero is Howard Rourke, and Howard Rourke is someone, say, that Donald Trump says that he identifies with. He refers to himself and Howard Rourke. There are people in his cabinet that also, you know, name their yachts after Howard Rourke and so forth. So Howard Rourke is the sort of tall, red-headed, virile architect who is he's a modernist architect. So there's your European influence too. He's a modernist architect, and he is opposed by all of these. He's trying to implement his vision, but his vision isn't recognized by all of these mediocre people who are just want to do old-fashioned architecture that's kind of eclectic. They don't recognize his singular vision. The novel is his romance with Dominique Francon. There's a scene in there that's often referred to as the rape scene. It's not actually a rape. It's more like a sadomasochistic kind of encounter, but it's this sort of framework of violent desire of the two passionate achievers, and he fights with all the mediocre people who get in his way, the newspaper head, the union people, the architecture critics. He takes on everyone. And in the end, he and Dominique prevail, although she opposes him through a lot of the novel, creates a lot of the tension and the sexual tension in the novel. And then at the end, he's so angry that they had gone with their motley eclectic vision rather than his, that he blows up the public housing project that he was supposed to have designed, and then he's put on trial. And there's a very, very long speech that Howard Rourke gives defending his action of blowing up the public housing project near the end of The Fountainhead. So the reason I say that reflects her experience of capitalism in Hollywood is that she got there and really admired and thought Cecil B. DeMille was a hero, a creative genius. She loved his films, and she went there. She started out, she was an extra, then she was a scriptwriter. But she began to discover that decisions were made that were business decisions in Hollywood that were not purely about the creative genius of the director or writer. And she started calling Cecil B. DeMille a box office chaser. And of course, that's as though that were a put down, but of course, that's the nature of Hollywood capitalism. Being a box office chaser is what it's all about. And she then saw herself as this heroic individual, creative person in Hollywood who was not able to succeed there as much as she would like to as a writer because of the mediocre, trying to please the masses, trying to make money, of all these inferior, mediocre people who got in her way. And that became the plot of The Fountainhead, which was then transferred to New York and transferred to architecture. But so here is this person who's positioning herself as the major defender of capitalism in the United States, but The Fountainhead misunderstands the nature of capitalism. And it misunderstands the nature of the context of Hollywood in which she tried to make it there. She preserved an ideal of capitalism that had almost nothing to do with the actual practice of capitalism in the early 20th century U.S., so that she would be cast aspersions on the box office chasers when, you know, that's definitionally what Hollywood capitalism is about box office chasing. So,
and do you think that might have something to do with the appeal of the book? Because she's, you know, in effect, criticizing capitalist society from the right, that what is in fact the reality of society is too crass, and, you know, there's not the appreciation of the elite people who are so creative.
Yes. I mean, it's both too crass and not crass enough, right?
Sure.
It's too crass because people are box office chafers, but it's not crass enough in that people don't just dominate, let the superior people dominate. That if you want to make money, you actually have to pander. And she doesn't. She doesn't think anyone should pay. She thinks that's beneath her to pander. But you can't make money if you don't pander. So she's caught in a contradiction there. Anyway, but yes, I think especially when one of the things I most want to explain is what you brought up at the beginning, which is why in 2008, right, is there a very big popularity boost in her, and why is it that people who advocate particularly neoliberal, the form of capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, rather than welfare state capitalism, right, or other forms of capitalism, why she's particularly popular with them. Because they're arguing, I mean, actually David Harvey, who wrote The Economist, who wrote a book, a very widely read book that's an introduction to, it's called A Brief History of Neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. So it gives you a kind of outline of what is neoliberalism. And one of the things he says is that neoliberalism is a fantasy. Right, it's not reality. That actually people are living in an oligarchy, and they are projecting it as this kind of pure kind of competitive free market capitalism, which does not exist. And so that's, I think, the key to her popularity in this later period, is that she's rejecting the sort of actually lived form while projecting this kind of fantasy figure that is the fantasy of this form of capitalism itself. So, you know, it's full of ironies and contradictions, which I try to some extent to explain. I mean, like Donald Trump thinks he's Howard Rourke, but he's really an Ayn Rand villain, right? He's a crony capitalist. He panders absolutely in order to get elected. He uses the state to advance his own business. All of that is absolutely evil in Ayn Rand's universe, and her evil, you know, figures are very Trumpian. But he sees himself as Howard Rourke, because he's projecting that fantasy romance hero, libidinalized, you know, purely competitive winner as what he wants to project. And that's what she does. She projects this libidinalized, idealized winner as the kind of avatar of capitalism. But that's not what capitalism actually is. And or has been historically. So her popularity is attached to the way people are invested in that fantasy, which is very deeply invested in that fantasy. Someone like Paul Ryan, right, used to give copies of Atlas Shrugged out to his entire staff and require them to read it. But then when it was pointed out to him by some reporters that she was an atheist who was against who thought drugs should be legal, he then came back the next day and said actually he'd made a mistake. He was really a fan of Thomas Aquinas.
Lisa Dugan is my guest. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're speaking about the ideas of Ayn Rand, the incredibly influential ideas. I'm joined by Lisa Dugan, who has written a lengthy essay titled Mean Girl, Ayn Rand and the Culture of Greed. That's published by UC Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's professor of social and cultural analysis at NYU. Well, during these years, the years of the Fountainhead, following those particularly after World War II, there was a ramping up of the Cold War. And Hollywood, which is where Ayn Rand got her start in the United States, became contested ground where those who were looking for Reds under the beds were pointing. How did Rand negotiate that, and how did she misread in some ways the ways that the Hollywood moguls, who in many ways, you know, she would identify with, dealt with the emerging McCarthyism?
Yeah, you know, if, how she would handle it, the short answer is badly. she really damaged her reputation in the way that she handled it. Of course, the McCarthy period was very, very complicated for the Hollywood moguls to manage, because on the one hand, they wanted to collaborate with the anti-communists in order to keep their industry away from being attacked and regulated, right? So they wanted to go along with McCarthyism to a certain extent in order to keep their industry out of the crosshairs, right, of government restriction and regulation. But on the other hand, they were mostly Jewish immigrants. And so they understood that they were fundamentally under attack, that McCarthyism had a very, very strong anti-Semitic as well as anti-communist element, and that they themselves were, in a sense, targets, potentially, seriously, targets of the kind of social movement surrounding anti-communism and McCarthyism. So they were very calculated and careful. There have been a couple of really great books written about this period and the way the Hollywood moguls tried to manage being anti-communist enough, but not too much, to try to stand up to some extent and then against the attempts to suppress communism in Hollywood, and on the other hand to balance that with a public image. So they were very careful about what they said. They were very careful about what groups they joined. They were very careful about how they testified. Not Ayn Rand, because she did not understand any of these complications. So she had a purist position of anti-communist and anti-Soviet. She was a witness before the House Un-American Activities Committee, in which she named names. She belonged to a group in Hollywood where she was the only Jewish person who was a member of the McCarthyist anti-communist group in the motion picture industry, many of whom were anti-Semites. And there were none of the Jewish moguls were a member of it, but she was. When she went to D.C. to testify, she denounced movies made by some of these moguls who were trying to manage the situation, and she denounced their movies, right? And she denounced them in sometimes cartoonish and ridiculous forms. There was one that she denounced because it showed Soviet people smiling. And she knew that that didn't happen. So she gave not only cartoonish testimony, but testimony that really thoughtlessly was damaging to the interest of the Hollywood moguls, and that it completely ruined her reputation, right, in any kind of Hollywood context. So she was completely boxed out then, and she became much more isolated after that. She took up politics in various ways. She was part of the Barry Goldwater campaign and lots of other things she took up. But she pretty much, you know, was no longer welcome in Hollywood. And she had really damaged her reputation rather broadly with the kind of businessman who wants to negotiate his interests with the state rather than defy the state.
And in 1951, she moved away from Hollywood. She moved to New York City. Yeah. And she was working at the time on what she would think of as her masterpiece, Atlas Shrugged, which was published in 1957. Tell us about the world she inhabited in New York and this fractious small group of free market true believers that she was the leading light within. You mentioned them earlier. Alan Greenspan was a member.
Yes, was part of her, the inner circle. Yes, well, so, you know, she created this little group around her of super fans, and they started an institute where they gave lectures, and that expanded so much that they then sent the taped lectures out around the country, and then there were groups formed around the country to study her work. work and to listen to these tape lectures that were given by her various acolytes, especially Nathaniel Brandon, with whom she had a secret affair. But so that group became, as time went on, it became more and more of a kind of cult, and where she was treated as always right about everything, and where people who criticized her were expelled from the group. So there started to be lots of little fights on the libertarian right. Right at this moment, there's a splits between various parts of the right, between a kind of religious conservatism of someone like William Buckley, the kind of anti-communism of the John Birch Society, also mixed with religion, and the kind of libertarians who are followers of Ayn Rand, who eventually came to be called objectivists, with the name she gave her philosophy. So this a group called objectivists, and they style themselves as philosophers, but they are true believers, and they police the opinions of anyone who would like to call themselves an objectivist. And she started getting very bad press for that. There were a whole series of articles then making fun of her and her group as a cult and having laughable or extreme views. That started to come out alongside. She also got a lot of positive publicity. She was interviewed for Playboy. She was interviewed by Mike Wallace. She had a campus lecture tour that was very popular. But over time, the negative publicity overtook the positive publicity, and by the late 60s and into the 70s, she was a very isolated figure.
I'm speaking with Lisa Dugan about Ayn Rand. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So her legacy through the 60s and 70s, especially into the 70s, the right, of course, reimagines itself at that time. But in many ways, although she had, on the one hand, enormous popularity as a writer, and Atlas Shrugged, despite having poor reviews, ended up by word of mouth becoming another mega bestseller. And at the same time, she's sort of inhabiting a world which is pretty marginal of the right. And of course, Ayn Rand dies in 1982. How do you see her complicated legacy, given those different strands, as what we call neoliberalism now, this notion of the unfettered free market being allowed to sort of do its thing, as that really emerges at the very end of her life and following her life? How do you trace her influence on that project?
Yeah, that's really the thing I'm most interested in trying to illuminate, right, in the last part of the book, because she does become this fairly isolated. She dies almost completely alone, but almost at the same time. I mean, at the same time, her work is those two novels, not all of her work, not her nonfiction, but those two novels remain enormously popular, remain bestsellers. So there's a small group of true believing objectivists who are Ayn Rand. That's one phenomenon. And then there's a broad reading public that reads these two novels, often in high school. The Ayn Rand Institute gives them away free to high schools. That's often why the high schools assign them. But also, in addition to that, then there's this movement of economists and policymakers for unregulated capitalism, leading to justifying greater inequality. And she has influence in all those three places. So her objectivist circle, the broad reading public, and this core of economists and policymakers who advocate for so-called free market capitalism. And it's in that space she becomes really an icon. Among those economists and those policymakers become really predominant in the Europe and the United States from the 1980s forward. So that's after she dies. And she becomes an avatar for them, an icon, someone who represents their views, that the welfare state is might as well be socialism. It's mediocre, it encourages inequality, that virtue is tied to competition and ruthless competition and unregulated competition, and that the heroic, virtuous figure is the winner, right? The one who plays hard and wins and is, you know, the sort of sexy, heroic winner, which is how Donald Trump imagines himself, right? That becomes the avatar of this phase of capitalism, as opposed to, say, you know, FDR and the phase of capitalism that was invested in something called the public good, right? We're no longer invested in the public good. Margaret Thatcher says there is no such thing as society. And that form of advocacy really hangs a lot of its emotional character, right? Its aesthetic character, its emotional character, its libidinal economy on Ayn Rand. She becomes a key figure there. So when people write histories of neoliberal capitalism from Thatcher, Reagan on, they write about Milton Friedman, they write about the International Monetary Fund, they write about what happened in Chile after the fall of the Soviet Union, they write about institutions and policies and ideologies, but they have generally neglected looking at the fantasies, the libidinal investments, and the emotions that are channeled into support for that kind of unregulated inequality. And Ayn Rand is the single most important, not the only, but the single most important figure for that. So I because she's a hack writer, and kind of a cartoon and not taken seriously for all kinds of good reasons, she doesn't get included in trying to analyze why, you know, neoliberal capitalism had come to be predominant, though it may be collapsing now. But and I think that Ayn Rand is a major recruiter of the structure of feeling that supports greed, inequality, and meanness.
And then that sort of takes us up to the present, which is, where does this all stand now? The term you use to describe that structure of feeling that her books channel is an optimistic cruelty, this sort of aspirational idea that the chosen can achieve while being absolutely indifferent to the suffering of others. So absolute justification for such an unequal society as ours. And yet at the same time, of course, we see, as in her day, various currents to the right. So although there certainly is that free market, libertarian thread, and as you point to, her ideas are very much embraced by people who see themselves as often great men, sometimes great women, in Silicon Valley. But then you also have the emergence of right-wing populism, which does not flow in the Randian way. How do you see her influence today? Is it contested? Does it still dominate? And do you have any sense of its future?
One can only hope that her reputation is doomed, but that would be being very optimistic. You know, it's a very, at the present, there's so much flux, right? I mean, there's so much flux. Something is that we're in a period of major transition, and we can't really quite see yet how things are going to shake out. So Trump here is a very illuminating figure for thinking about that, because he represents the nationalist right, the racial nationalism of a kind of pop, quote unquote, populist right wing. But his policies are pure neoliberal. Many of his policies are pure neoliberalism. So he has the right wing immigration policies that come from the nationalism, which conflict with what would be a pure neoliberalism, which would allow immigration to go unregulated to procure cheap labor for industrialists. But so he has a right-wing nationalist front around things like immigration and some trade issues. But the heart of his policy has been like the tax cut, the big tax cut.
Sure.
Right. A lot of his health care, his attempt to gut the ACA, the Obama health care initiative. A big hunk of what he does is pure, almost zombie neoliberalism, right? The most extreme neoliberal policy, which is represented by right-wing Republicans. I mean, Paul Ryan was a particularly pure example of that, and most of them are not pure. They mix various things. But this is a moment when those two things are tied together. So if you look around, whether it's in Brazil or whether it's in the Philippines or whether it's in India with Modi or whether it's on the right wing in Europe or Trump in the United States, right-wing populism in its pure form is not compatible particularly with neoliberalism in its pure form. But these right-wing figures merge the two. And they take a kind of neoliberal brutal inequality, capitalist inequality, and then they merge it with this sort of mean nationalism. So oddly, Ayn Rand shouldn't be a figure for right-wing nationalists because she was in every way opposed to that, to nationalism and to racialism as a tribal philosophy. I mean, there's a lot to say on her politics of race, but we'll leave that aside. I said quite a bit about it when I talked about the imperial narratives that are embedded in her work, but she has remained an icon for someone like Trump, right? And these people in his cabinet who are not neoliberals in the pure sense, but they are advocating neoliberal policies of various kinds. They overlap with the neoliberal wing of the Republican Party, and their pure aspirational meanness and indifference is very Randian as a structure of feeling. So she remains like an icon for people. It's kind of morphed into this somewhat different political period, and we don't know yet whether, as neoliberalism continues to collapse in various ways, whether right-wing racial nationalism will morph into something else, or whether the left will be truly competitive in terms of offering alternative visions of the social. And Ayn Rand is certainly incompatible with the left, but she has been compatible with the center rightward for a very strong, wide spectrum of political figures.
You've been emphasizing the power of Ayn Rand's ideas are connected to the structure of feeling that she evokes in her novels particularly. In your essay, you note that the right is constantly learning from the left and studying the left. Do you think that there's anything that the left can learn about the power of Ayn Rand's writings?
And that is, the right has really learned the power, have really deploys the power of feeling, the power of narrative, the power of aspiration and identification. And large sections of the left want to appeal with a kind of, a kind of rationalism that separates off emotion and storytelling.
Lisa Dugan, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Lisa Dugan. She is professor of social and cultural history at NYU, and she's the author of Mean Girl, Ayn Rand and the Culture of Greed, which you can find on againstthegrain.org. She's a historian, journalist, and activist, and the author of The Twilight of Equality. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.